Welcome to the 34 Circe Salon.
Welcome to Make Matriarchy Great Again.
And welcome everyone to the 34 Circe Salon. This is the Make Matriarchy Great Again podcast. I am Sean Marla Newcomb and I'm here with
Dawn Sam Alden. Welcome, welcome everyone.
And it's our favorite topic. It's Amazons, and it's a special Amazon with a special guest.
Indeed, indeed. We have a return guest with us today, Walter Penrose, who you may remember as having appeared on this podcast before. Welcome back, Walter.
Thank you, Dawn and Sean. I appreciate it. Nice to be with you.
Yes, it's so nice to have you again. And we're so excited about talking to you about this topic.
It's like Jeopardy when a returning champion comes back.
So. There you go. So for those of you who haven't heard our previous podcasts with Walter, would you introduce yourself?
Sure. I am an associate professor of history at San Diego State University. I'm the author of a book on Amazons, which is entitled Postcolonial Amazons, Female Masculinity and Courage in Ancient Greek and Sanskrit Literature. And I've also written an article about feminism and the reception of the Amazons in Wonder Woman called The Unwanted Gaze, which is, I think, what we're here to talk about today.
Indeed, indeed. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure our listeners will have heard of the male gaze, the concept of the male gaze, which here in Hollywood we talk about a lot. And that this is the idea that the camera perceives the women in any piece of film or television specifically through the eyes of a heterosexual male gaze that sexualizes all of the women that the camera looks at. So the camera's eye is gendered. So that's sort of this phrase, the male gaze. And yes, we're going to talk about this wonderful paper that sort of takes a look at specifically the 2017 Wonder Woman that Patty Jenkins directed. And then we're actually going to start way back with the Greek the Amazons as perceived by the Greeks, go through William Marston's Wonder Woman comic series, which is, of course, still being written, and then end with that 2017 movie. So Sean and Walter, do you want to launch right into the first section?
Yeah, I also want to say I love Postcolonial Amazons, Walter. I have it bookmarked with lots of things and lots of stuff that comes up. So it's definitely something people should read. So let's jump into the old days. Let's go back in the old days, old school, to the Amazon myths, because your paper starts with that. It's framed in the paper that, you know, we talk about putting aside, you know, the historical aspects of the story, but what the legend meant for the Greeks. So could we just start there for what were the main myths and legends about the Amazons in ancient Greece? And then we can kind of get into how they were used and what purpose they served.
Sounds good.
So, I mean, we have Hippolyta and Penthesilea. I think we actually did an episode on that that were released talking about those two. So we could start there and then go to the Amazonomachy. I always wonder if I'm pronouncing that right. And
Amazonomachy.
Amazonomachy. Okay.
Amazonomachy. That is a mouthful.
Yeah. So what were the kind of dominant tales that maybe the average Greek in the classical era would have been familiar with or would have associated with the Amazons?
Well, you know, the Amazons do show up in the Trojan War legends. So probably the most important text from an ancient Greek standpoint is the Iliad. Right? The texts of Homer are very important in Greek culture. You know, some might even say kind of like a Bible of Greek culture in a way, right? A text with that much authority and power. Of course, the Amazons are only mentioned briefly in Homer's Iliad, but there were other poems in that cycle of poems, which we call the epic cycle, that talked about how the Amazon Penthesilea came to Troy and fought on behalf of the Trojans. And so that is probably, at least chronologically speaking, in terms of, you know, how these myths develop, the earliest, right, that we have something recorded about, although most of what we know comes from, you know, later summaries of lost texts. But putting that aside, we also see the Amazon Penthesilea on a Greek vase that's owned by the British Museum today. And what happens in the story of Penthesilea is that she comes to Troy and she winds up involved in a duel with Achilles, you know, the great yet angry warrior of ancient Greeks.
He's kind of not a nice guy. It's the way right. I always take it in that work. Yeah, yet angry. Exactly.
Right, right. Yeah. And I mean, maybe other warriors are angry too, right? But you know, that's, you know, it's Achilles' anger that's really, you know, one of the main themes of the Iliad. But in any event, she fights Achilles and very valiantly, but he overpowers her and kills her with his spear. And so the story goes, and this is again preserved in much later texts, as she sort of lays dying in his arms, he pulls back her helmet and beholds this vision of loveliness and falls in love with her. And so that is, you know, coming from a much later text of Quintus of Smyrna. But in any event, and, you know, there's even one text from the Middle Ages that probably has some rather necrophiliac things going on. Anyway, we won't go there.
Right.
You don't, probably don't want to know, right? Right. This story can get pretty, well, I don't even know what the word to describe it is. That's the story of Penthesilea.
Can I geek out for a second and ask you a question? Because sure. It's a great chance to ask. So the Ethiopians, I'm obsessed with the Ethiopians because I would like to, my fantasy is that somewhere that work is hidden in a jar of clay somewhere. Do we have any, has there been any thought of where potentially anyone might, and just so for the list of the Ethiopians has this story about Penthesilea in it, and it's part of the epic cycle, and it's very exciting if you have any interest in the Amazons. I mean, is there any thought that there may be any chance of recovering more of the lines of it or any of the text? This is just me, you know, kind of like fantasy football, me wondering what possibly is out there.
There's always that potential if, you know, something is found, say in Egypt, sometimes they uncover a new mummy who's been wrapped in, you know, papyrus, you know, or that has a mummy mask made out of papyrus anyway. And so, you know, mummies are usually wrapped in linen, but sometimes papyrus gets in there as well. You know, they use what they have. And so there's always the possibility that some new lines might turn up, but they haven't. And so it also depends on how popular that text was, right? So Sappho, we know, was very popular and very popular among the Egyptians, right, of that time, you know, the Greek-speaking Egyptians anyway. Because we keep finding more and more bits and pieces of Sappho written on this kind of, you know, papyrus debris. But I'm not aware of anything, and I'm personally not super hopeful that we'll find that poem. I wish we would, right? I'm with you.
Yeah.
It would
be amazing.
I wonder, would it have been because they're Egypt and Ethiopia, and since the Ethiopians, and it's about Memnon, the Ethiopian warrior, maybe there's a little sort of regional rivalry. So maybe that wasn't, he won't find quite as much there on the Ethiopus. Who knows?
That's an interesting thought. Yeah,
I hadn't thought about that before.
That's very interesting. Yeah. Hard to say it. And what the Greeks thought was Ethiopia also, you know, kind of varied. Some of them thought, you know, I mean, basically what the term means in Greek is, you know, having burnt skin, right? You know, having a tan, basically, or darker skin, right? As we would say. And so, you know, that was also extended over into Asia, right? Some people among the ancient Greeks thought that Ethiopia was part of Asia, you know, and some part of, you know, thought it was, you know, more so in Africa. So it's kind of, there's some also strange stuff that goes on there geographically among the Greeks.
Mm-hmm. Well, so Hippolyta, oh, sorry, don't please.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to, you had mentioned about Penthesilea, and we thought we would maybe talk about Hippolyta and a little bit about what the Greeks were, where her myth fit in. I know, Dawn, obviously we had a little long discussion about that on one of our episodes just recently.
Well, Hippolyta, like, you know, Penthesilea is an Amazon queen. She has this belt, right? What we would, in Greek, it's called a zoster, right? And it's a war belt. But later in Wonder Woman, it becomes a girdle, right? And I don't think that's really the best way to describe it from an ancient Greek context. Because, you know, she's an Amazon. She's wearing a war belt. And, it, you know, it's probably somewhere you hook your sword and you know.
And your axe. And,
right. You know, something utile, as the word would be, right? You want it to be something that's useful for your warlike activities. And so Heracles' ninth labor is that, you know, he is supposed to go and get this, you know, war belt from Hippolyta. It's one of 12 labors that he has to perform in order to redeem himself. In any event, he goes, and, you know, there are various versions of the story. In some of them, you know, Hippolyta willingly gives him the girdle, but Hera, right, the queen of the gods, is always jealous of Heracles, and she doesn't like him, and so she comes in and creates all sorts of chaos, and so they're, you know, the Amazons kind of spark up anyway and attack the Greeks. But in others, you know, the story is less flattering towards Heracles, who really does go in and very hubristically takes this girdle and kills Hippolyta. And Hippolyta, though, does show up in a different myth that is sometimes confused with the Amazon Antiope. Antiope, I think how they pronounce it in the in the film. Mm-hmm. In any event, what happens is that in this version of the myth, the Greek Theseus steals Hippolyta. He abducts her and takes her back to Greece. And then the Amazons follow after her and attack ancient Athens to get Hippolyta back. Although, as I said earlier, in a number of the versions of this, it is the Amazon Antiope who is abducted by Theseus. And then there's one version of the myth where Antiope actually goes kind of willingly with Theseus. And I think that's the version of the myth that we see replicated, whether purposely or not, you know, we don't know, but I think probably purposely, by William Moulton Marston in the story of Diana and Steve Trevor, right? Because Steve Trevor kind of arrives more, a little more accidentally, you know, he's not showing up looking for, you know, conquest and so forth. But, you know, I think that myth is probably what we're seeing there.
We see its echo later. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of how myth is. You know, we see various versions of it, sometimes with different names with different endings, of course. And, you know, what happens in that myth is a bit different, because in Wonder Woman, you know, the Amazons survive and carry on. And that's the wonderful thing about Wonder Woman, right? Because we want Amazons to survive. And
absolutely.
This is make matriarchy great again, right? You know,
right.
What more do we want than Amazons to, like, live and flourish and film and, you know, theater and so forth?
If only we had our sound effects. We have no sound effects with us right now.
You could put in some applause later. So basically, these you mentioned these sort of stock roles for Amazons were a couple of different. They served a sort of couple of different functions in Greek myth. And sort of the major one is to be a foil for Greek heroes, right? They have to have a great enough rival that overcoming that great rival makes them even greater.
Yeah. And that is one of the most interesting and curious things about these myths. And while one of the reasons I've always thought there's some historical aspect to this, right? Because, first of all, the Greeks on gender, maybe the Spartans were actually a little better than other Greeks like the Athenians, but, you know, they get a real zero when it comes to, you know, sort of gender yes. roles and feminists on the whole, right? You know?
Right, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Know, they fail the test, right? I'm the professor, I can say it, right? but, you know, so where was I going with all that? Oh, right. So in any event, but, you know, so why is there an Amazon fighting a Greek, right? Why do Heracles and Theseus and Achilles, I mean, every great hero in Greek history or legend, shall we say, fights an Amazon and defeats her, right? Right. That's part of their story motifs. And so, of course, they fight others, two other warriors. It's kind of difficult to know why this is always going on. One theory that I've had is that, you know, when we look at the order Lysias, for example, he talks about how, you know, the Amazons, you know, learn how to use iron and they defeat all their foes. But it's not until they meet the Greeks that they actually find their match, right? So one right. thing that happens with the Amazons is that they're kind of used as a way to sort of make barbarian men look like wimps. That's what the Greeks do, right? I'm not saying that barbarian men were wimps, right? And let me explain what I mean by barbarian. I mean non-Greek, right?
Right.
And so right. not necessarily uncivilized, which is yeah. kind of what a modern audience might think. But from a Greek standpoint, we would say barbarian. And so I think that might be part of what's going on, but it's one of the harder aspects of these myths to kind of, you know, understand. And, you know, when no one's left us the guidebook on how to understand the myths, but I think that, you know, it's maybe has something to do with that.
You have that wonderful quote from Lysias in your paper. When they encountered noble men, they acquired spirits like their nature and they appeared to be women. So in other words, once they saw the real men that were the Greeks, they realized their place and, you know, went back to being submissive women like the Greeks preferred.
Well, it's funny. We see that actually in contemporary film. We've seen it in first century film, and it's usually we portray it as sort of Western and non-Western. So it becomes kind of
right.
like if the woman is non-Western, it might be she's, you know, this sort of virago of sorts. But then when she meets the, you know, James Bond, she's softened. But, you know, it's sort of that same trope still exists and is carried. I mean, I think there's a lot of interesting things, obviously, for me, and we've talked about this many times. I believe that there's a lot to the historical aspect of this. But, you know, because there's just so much specificity around certain things. But definitely this trope is very powerful in there. I mean, there is also, you know, so there's the foil for the Greek man, but there's also, right, I guess the sort of the cautionary tale for the Greek woman, right? The idea that, you know, this don't try to be too Amazonian or, you know, it's going to be pushed down. It's going to be tamped down.
Right, right. Of course, you know, marriage was expected of Greeks, of men and women, really, both. And but, you know, the pressure on a woman was much more at a much younger age, right, to get married.
Right.
Or, you know,
right.
Hesiod says something about the Greeks, you know, a woman would get married around age 15, right, a man around age 30. So that's quite a difference, first of all. So, you know, as a man, you could kind of get away with it. So there's this intense expectation that a woman get married, a young woman, you know, take up, you know, the abode with her husband and, you know, raise children and so on and so forth. And so that's one way that the myth of the Amazons has been understood, right? You know, the Amazons are defeated because women shouldn't, you know, rise up and challenge male authority. They should, you know, stay underneath it. And so that's one way to think about it. Another way, I guess, would be that, you know, there's a battle of the sexes. This is, you know, kind of what I'll call the 1970s approach. Right, but maybe 1980s.
And, like Billie Jean King versus Bobby Riggs.
Right.
If anybody remembers the sports Thank reference. You. Sorry for Thank the yeah, sorry for yeah. the sports no, reference again, that. Dawn. But it's
that's all right.
That's yeah, and I think that scholars are, you know, they do tend to think in the ways that society is thinking at the time. That's one of the things that happens. Yet at the same by the same token. Right, you know, the battle of the Amazons against the Greeks is always a battle of men versus women.
Right.
So how much is this really just a battle of the sexes? And, you know, how much is it about domestic concerns, right? And that's yeah. sort of another.
Yeah, and you give a couple of examples of the sort of cautionary tale element of it where the Greeks give examples of civilizations where, you know, the Greek men didn't come along and beat the Amazons, but the women were in charge and how awful it was to have a nation ruled by women.
Oh, can we say that word too, Dawn? We'll have to ask Walter the proper pronunciation. Ethnos gynokokratumenon.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Are we close there?
Yeah, you're good. Gynokokratumenon.
Wow, that's a mouthful.
Ethnos means kind of like, you know, like a group of people, like an ethnicity. I don't want to oversimplify it, but that's, you know, I think for our purposes that's good enough. And then you know, the term gyne, right, like gynecologist, it means a woman's doctor. So the Greek word gyne means woman. And then kratumenon means, you know, having been ruled by, has to do with rulership. And so basically this means a society ruled by women. Of course, that is the myth of the Amazons that's preserved by Diodorus. There are some possible thoughts that it, you know, there may have been some version of this myth earlier. Of course, there are more historical peoples like the Sarumatians, for example,
right.
whom a Greek historian, Ephorus, calls gynokokratumenon as well. Right. So, and the Sarumatians and the Scythians and the Thracians all sort of have these kind of similar gender roles for where women seem to have fought, and probably the historical inspiration behind the Amazon myths of the Greeks.
Right. And Diodorus, you mentioned, makes up this story about how the women in this society, those evil ruling women, actually maim the male members of society so that they are forced into the roles of domestics that, you know, are naturally the roles for women. They actually broke the legs of the male children.
Yes, yes. And so that is how they kind of maintain their rule over men. Which is, as I think one of you mentioned a little bit ago, you know, kind of this, you know, sinister aspect to that story. Where it's interesting to see what Marston will do with that, because he takes this idea of,
right,
of matriarchy, right, you know, as to be something good, right, that we should all, right, aspire to. And you know, given where the planet's going, I'm there, right, you know.
Well, you...
I think a lot of people are there, Walter.
Women have a shot at it, right?
You know? Right. Yeah. Absolutely. It's about time to go back to that. Yeah, so, you know, the Greeks using this idea of, well, if women were in charge, and we see this in modern society still, this idea that if we flipped the genders, that women would be just as bad, if not worse, as the men who have subjugated and oppressed women over the millennia.
Yeah.
It's probably a good spot to transition to what.
Yeah.
But before, just one question though, Walter, before we go to Marston and sort of how he's kind of flips that, there was something you mentioned that we had just had a really fun discussion about Artemis, the last podcast we did. We haven't released it yet. And we were talking about the worship, the religious aspect of it, the Amazon's connection to it. There's a mention you have about Apollonius, who said that the Amazons prayed it was a black stone. And I just wondered, because it seems so similar to the whole Kybele, the Roman Magna Martyr, the black stone, so the Great Mother. Was there any kind of connection there? Is that, you know, was there any mention of that? Worship, because he sees it as Ares, but it seems like it's very Great Mother worship.
Well, I mean, both of these cults are coming from either Anatolia, ancient Turkey, mm-hmm. or from an island just off the northern coast of Turkey. And so, you know, we think we've found where that island is. Ah. There is a small island in the Black Sea there. So it's possible that there's some relationship, you know, between these two cults. They're both sort of focused on this worshiping this black stone, which then represents a god. In the one case, the god Tibili, right, the mother mm-hmm. of the gods. And then that black stone was imported to Rome in the 2nd century BC from the kingdom of Pergamon, you know, which was a Roman ally. And of course, you know, the Pergamenes were pretty much dependent on Rome for military support. So they're like, sure, you can have our precious, you know, stone, even though, you know, she's such an important goddess. And so that there is a similarity with the black stone being there. And, you know, these are all Greek interpretations of mm-hmm. these cults. So hard to say, right, what the mm-hmm. real story behind those interpretations might be, Greek or Roman interpretations, I should say, in the case of the Magna Mater, right, which is another name, Great Mother for Kybele.
Mm-hmm. What was the island that they think that it was on that they found?
Oh, Adrian Mayer just calls it Amazon Island. I think it's I've forgotten if it has I'm sure it has an actual name in Turkish, but I don't know it.
Next vacation we'll all head over.
We'll have to follow up with that. Yeah,
a good place to go. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? Absolutely. So years ago we actually did a podcast episode on William Marston and the Wonder Women, for our listeners, Walter, could you give just sort of a brief, from what you know, just sort of a real brief background of William Moulton Marston and sort of how the Wonder Woman comic was born?
I'd be happy to. And I really, you know, when I read Jill Lepore's Secret History of Wonder Woman, I just became fascinated with the Marstons. And, you know, I've always sort of wanted to write something up and entitle it Meet the Marstons. So we'll just call this Meet the Marstons segment of Make Matriarchy Great Again, okay?
Awesome.
And it has a lot of M's going on there. Meet the Marstons on...
Make Matriarchy, exactly.
Yeah, Anyway, so... Mm-hmm. And so, okay. Basically, we have William Moulton Marston, who was this guy that, you know, dabbled in all sorts of things, right? He was involved in the invention of the lie detector.
Right.
I don't want to say that he single-handedly invented the lie detector, because, you know, I think there were other people, his mentor, Hugo Munsterberg, and others who were working on it at the same time. So he's very interesting from that perspective, as well as his own personal life. He lived in a very polyamorous relationship, which the film that came out around the same time as Wonder Woman, that detailed, you know, the life of the Marstons, which was entitled, if I remember correctly, I think it was Professor Marston and the Wonder Women.
Yes, I believe
yes,
so.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
Yeah, and that showed that he had, you know, a three-way relationship with two other women, Elizabeth Holloway and Olive Byrne, But the person who's left out of the film is Marjorie Wilkes Huntley. So there was a third woman kind of involved in this polyamorous relationship. And I've always wondered why did they leave her out of that film? Because I think she's an important character in the development of Wonder Woman. You know, there's a lot of kind of bondage and domination. Wonder Woman's always getting tied up by some criminals. She always manages to get out of being tied up, right? Mm-hmm. Noah Brulatsky has written on this subject, right, of BDSM in Wonder Woman. In any event, Marjorie Wilkes Huntley was the person who kind of taught William Moulton Marston about, you know, bondage and domination, these kinds of things. And these were aspects that he used in his psychological theories, right? You know, he thought that, people submitting to a willing authority was really something that was good for them, right? And would make them, kind of feel better about authority. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, someone who was, trying to dominate other people's wasn't really going to have the best result. You know, the best results you get from other people is what Marston called inducement, right? Which is persuading people to do things, right? And then they will submit willingly. So he was a psychologist, right? He had a law degree. He had a PhD in, at the time, his PhD would have been in philosophy, but psychology kind of evolved out of philosophy, which is one of the things we learned from the story. And, you know, he really had difficulty. He was fired from at least 3 academic jobs. His personal life, I think, had a lot to do with it. Mm-hmm. He had in his Emotions of Normal People, a 1928 publication, he had really, given a thumbs up for what I call, you know, from an ancient historian's perspective, female homoeroticism, but, you know, erotic relations between women. Not between men. He didn't give those a stamp of approval. So he's someone who was, you know, really in the 1920s kind of involved in what we, you know, call the Roaring 20s, right? Or, you know, the sexual revolution of the 20s. He was someone who really was a thinker in this way. But, you know, there was kind of a backlash against him, and his peers didn't think in it. And also with the lie detector, which was one of his big inventions, right? He just had trouble getting that off the ground for whatever reason. It didn't help that he didn't patent it. What he was doing with that was not a smart plan.
Right.
But that's a little bit about his relationship. And of course, his wife was quite a Elizabeth Holloway Marston was quite a feminist and a suffragette. She was college educated. And back in those days, we learned that what it meant to be an Amazon was a woman who actually went to school and left the house, right? Went to university.
Right.
And so that's interesting too. She read Greek. She was interested in Sappho. She read all the poetry of Sappho and in fact died at 100 years of age with a copy of Sappho's poems on her bedstand, right? Shows you how much she loved Sappho. And then we have Olive Byrne, who was Marston's other full-time partner. And she was the daughter of Ethel Byrne, who'd gone on a hunger strike, right? Went in prison for opening a birth control clinic in New York City.
Right.
And she was the niece of Ethel's sister, Margaret Sanger, whom you may have heard of, right? Who was a very important character in first wave feminism. It's quite controversial today over her views on eugenics, as are a number of characters from that time. But Margaret Sanger was extremely important in advancing birth control and, other aspects of feminism in this country.
Right. Yeah. It's you also mentioned in there were a couple of things in your paper that sort of tweaked my interest when you talk about the Marstons. And one of them was that William Morrison sort of forced his lover, Olive, on his wife at the beginning, at least, by threatening to leave her if she didn't agree to the polygamous relationship. And that's kind of interesting, because then there's also this sort of like little interesting fact about her love of Sappho and how Sappho is associated with lesbian relationships. I mean, the island that Sappho lived on, Lesbos, sort of gave us the word lesbianism to describe female homoerotic relationships. And so there is this sort of interesting, like, did she or didn't she type of mystery that who knows if we'll ever solve about how much of the polyamory that went on in their household was Elizabeth an enthusiastic partner to, and how much of it was sort of something she agreed to in order to advance her other goals.
Oh, that's a great question. And, you know, a couple of things I can think of in response are that, you know, I mean, first of all, you're right. How do we know what she personally was thinking? Because we really don't, they kept so much of this personal life private, or tried to anyway.
Right.
And, you know, it kind of came out in dribs and drabs from the children and so forth later. But two thoughts I have are, one, you know, they were involved in this love cult, which of all things is something that they did at the home of Marston's aunt.
Right.
Which I find rather fascinating, right? And, but, you know, so, and this seems to have been sort of a love training camp. And, you know, with constellations of women to one man, right? So I think that Marston clearly liked this idea of, you know, being in a polygynous relationship. When I say polygyny, meaning, you know, many women and one man, right? As opposed to polyamorous or polygamous, right? Which could have, you know, another meaning, right? You could have more men.
Right.
And then the other thing that's of interest is, however all this started with Olive Byrne and Elizabeth Holloway, after Marston died, they continued to live together. And I believe he died in 1948. And they continued to live together for at least another 30 years, the two women.
Right.
And so they never separated.
Right. So whatever the beginning of that was, they did develop some sort of bond that was definitely their own.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fascinating. Yeah.
And of course, you know, I mean, they had lived together as a family, and what I guess Elizabeth Holloway, you know, she had a law degree, but she couldn't find work as a lawyer. But nonetheless, she wanted to work outside of the home. And so she worked more as, you know, in various types of office jobs. I think it eventually became an editor, right? And never really practiced law to speak of. And so, which is a shame, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wouldn't be until Ruth Bader Ginsburg and we could finally get, you know, women on the bench, right?
Right.
And, you know, and so forth. But yeah, but she apparently wanted to work. And so Olive Byrne raised the children. There were four children. Each woman had two children with Marston. And so that's kind of the other arrangement that they kind of made. So it kind of worked to Elizabeth or Betty, you know, Marston's advantage in one way, even if she wasn't happy in the beginning with how it was all going to go down. But,
right.
Yeah, but she was given no choice. That's the story we're told.
Right. And the, you know, this sort of yearning for the ability to work outside the home definitely shows up in the Wonder Woman comics, with Wonder Woman urging the economic independence of women as one of, you know, the viewpoints that she espoused.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So sort of tying this back into matriarchy, I think we'll touch on that before we get to the bondage. So because we are, make matriarchy great again, it is interesting that the arrangement of sort of the women living together and raising the children, it has a very sort of matriarchal feel. And a lot of what the sort of it is gender essentialism. You mention in your paper that, you know, there was definitely Marston definitely had a very gender essentialist view of men and women, but that he had this idea that women are peaceful, men are more aggressive, and that if we submit to women's rule, essentially to loving authority, that our society will be improved by this. And this, coming at it from sort of a psychological viewpoint, it is interesting how it sort of is like matriarchy, but there is still what pings in my mind, and I'd love to hear what you have to think about this, Walter, is that it is still very much as long as the guy is into it type of feel to it.
Yeah. I mean, and apparently the house was, my recollection from the readings I've done is that, you know, I mean, I think that William Moulton Marston kind of was in charge, right? You know?
Right.
Not that he didn't, probably his relationship with his wife and, you know, and the other women in his life, his partners, I should say, maybe is a better way to describe all three of them, was probably something where he did take their thoughts and, you know, feelings into consideration, unlike, you know, some other relationships one might find out there in the past. But I do think that, you know, first of all, I mean, he had trouble holding down a full-time job, right? He had trouble with his day job, so to speak, until Wonder Woman came along. And so he was very much reliant on particularly Betty Holloway, his wife, to, you know, bring home the bacon.
Right.
And, you know, he did various things, but he had a lot of things that didn't work out, right? You know, he was going to be a consultant in Hollywood. That didn't really work out, you know. He was there on the sort of the opening cusp, the edge of psychology as a discipline, and wrote a lot of books and, you know, worked as a professor, but that didn't really work out. But what did work out big time was Wonder Woman.
Right.
And so, and of course, we do know that one of the children later said that it was Betty's idea to, you know, create a superwoman. And so I think one of the interesting aspects of this whole story is that there's probably a lot more that these women did in terms of helping to create this character and, you know, dinner conversation, right? Well, why don't you ever do this? Why don't you ever do that? That
sure.
We don't know about.
Right.
And
sure. Sure.
Neither of them took credit, right? None of them took credit, I should say. There were three of them for, you know, having been involved a lot in the writing of the comics.
Yeah.
Is there in his background, well, one, just also as a comment, that certainly this was an era, I believe Aldous Huxley had a similar kind of relationship set up. It seemed that there was kind of a polyamory that was happening with different aspects of perhaps matriarchal overtones. And certainly there was, like, I guess, a matriarchy movement in the late 19th and early 20th century. Did Marston, is there anything else in Marston's personal background, just thinking about his psychology, where this comes from, you know, keeping this in the Wonder Woman vein, the idea that he's going to promote this, use this comic book to promote these matriarchal ideas? Obviously, he's in a very female, surrounded, female-centered world, for want of a better term. Is there anything else? Do we know anything else of sort of the genesis of his sort of beliefs around this? I mean, has this come from, you know, you said his aunt had this, you know, house. Was there something in his family background, or was it something that he discovered? I know you mentioned the things he had experimented with psychologically. Where do we think that maybe this sort of sensibility or belief in matriarchy comes from? And then we can maybe talk a little bit about how he tried to express it in the comic.
Well, you get the sense from reading the biography written by Jill Lepore that his mother's family was rather kind of well-to-do and was probably more influential in his upbringing maybe than his father. And, you know, his mother had four sisters, so there were five of them all together. And her only brother had died, I believe. if she had one. And so I think that, you know, he might have grown up in a setting where there were a lot of women, and he kind of perhaps responded to that, you know, and was more open to sort of ideas about women because of that. And this is just, it's a guess. I'm making a guess here. But that, from his own background, would be one of the things I would say. And then, of course, when you're looking at Olive Byrne, you know, one of his partners, you know, obviously she comes from this very strong tradition of, you know, feminists who are fighting for birth control and women's rights. And so, and all of them were, you know, members of the suffragist clubs at, you know, the various colleges where they attended and so forth. And so, you know, very involved in that movement, which, you know, it was, you know, I think it was a movement that was probably really divided the country in many ways, but certainly we know which side of the coin they were on.
Sorry, go ahead, Tom.
No, I was just going to move us into a little bit more of the sort of bondage discussion. Unless you had more comments on what Walter just said, Sean?
The only thing I was just curious, you know, I think what you're going to discuss will probably lead us into this, but to get to what his kind of, the way his approach to presenting this information into the comic book, but this, that can wait till after we go through this part.
Yeah. Well, I loved the quote that you had in, or what you said in the paper about how Wonder Woman was a breathtaking fusion of feminism, patriotism, and kinky sex. which, you know, like what is there not to love about all of that, right? And even though you mentioned that, you know, the readership of Wonder Woman was 90% men and 10% girls, that 10%, I think you have a quote from some second wave feminists in your paper as well about how amazing it is as a woman, and I would imagine as a girl at that time, to be presented with a world like Wonder Woman lived in. Right, Paradise Island, and then later reflected again in the Holiday Girls and the sorority, where Etta Candy sort of enters the story. The headiness of seeing for the first time, or at least seeing is a very rare sight of a society of women. Essentially, all functioning together, working together for a cause, and what an incredible impact that must have made when it came out. And it still is something that in Hollywood and entertainment, as women, we are hungry for.
Sure. I mean, Gloria Steinem, you know, really picked up on, you know, how important Wonder Woman was in her own formative years, and, you know, being one of the leaders of second wave feminism, right? And so, you know, and also had made some comments to the thing, well, you know, seemed like a really strange society, where were the men, right? Could women not get along with men, you know, where was it impossible? And of course, then, you know, we also see at the same time in the 70s, you know, the development of lesbian feminism, right? Which
right.
was a real, you know, whole movement to, you know, kind of adopt the Amazon way of living wholesale, right? You know, and
yeah.
try to live without men, and, you know, what was called the Oregon Trail, I think, you know, or something like that. I think I'm messing that up, but, you know, sort of in Northern California and Southern Oregon, developed, you know, a lot of communities, as did other hippie type peoples who, you know, moved out to live on the land, and so, you know, they weren't the only people to do this, but yeah, I think that this idea of matriarchy, or, you know, for that matter, just a complete society without men was probably interesting. But also Wonder Woman, you know, comes into the society of men, right, chooses to sort of go and, you know, fight evil, but does it in this very sort of gentle way, right? You know, doesn't kill people, you know, ties them up, sends them off to Reform Island. And, you know, so there is an essentialist way of thinking about gender in all of these comics, right, that we see.
Yeah.
You know, women are loving, men are sort of evil, and, you know, and of course it may have, as my students remind me, I think this may over, you know, essentialize, right, the differences between
yes.
men and women. But on the other hand, it is an interesting way of, you know, thinking about how we might see some change.
Yeah, and that over, I think that essentialism is definitely very present in second wave feminism. The idea that men are this and women are this, and that the world is desperately in need of the feminine aspects. And I would say, you know, from third wave and fourth wave feminism, that is something that all of us need, and all of us have those aspects of our nature. We sort of assigned the second wave feminists sort of assigned it to men and women, but I think it is more aspects of all of our personality, and that in the patriarchy, yes, I said it, we have overdeveloped the masculine aspect that we all have inside of ourselves, this focus on aggression and dominance and conquering and colonialism and all that sort of thing. Whereas what Wonder Woman, the comic, espouses is this coming from love, this idea of ruling through love, and that is what all of us want more. And you know, Marston's talks about the ideas that produce pleasantness and harmony and emotions of feeling good are the ones that should be espoused by society as a whole.
Yeah, no, that's great and really astute.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Professor. One of the things that you mentioned briefly is the bondage. So let's talk briefly about that. And I love that you introduced it the way you did, which is that there is a practical aspect to this, which is that as a heroine, if Wonder Woman doesn't want to kill, the only thing left to do with the bad guys is to tie them up, right? Because if she knocks somebody out, she has to tie them up, or else when they come to, they're going to come after her again, unless she kills them, and she doesn't want to kill because she rules from love. So there is definitely a practical aspect to the bondage, which is that it is the only way to immobilize someone if you're not going to kill them. But there is a larger aspect to it with, you know, Wonder Woman mentioning frequently that they tie each other up on Paradise Island sort of as a matter of almost emotional and spiritual development. And I will interject here that a friend of mine and I actually took a bondage workshop, and we tied each other up. And he said that he felt a sense of peace when he was immobilized, that there was a sense of relaxation came over him. That was a very pleasant feeling as a response to being tied up. So there is this sort of emotional component to it that I find fascinating. But tell us a little bit more about this presence of bondage in both Marston's life and in the Wonder Woman comics, if you would.
Well, sure. I mean, I think, first of all, the fact that this was something he was interested in and, you know, was practicing in his personal life helps us to understand how it shows up in the comics, right? I think that's important. But it was more than just sort of a personal practice, right? He'd also developed this whole psychological theory around all of this, right? As I mentioned, the disc theory, dominance, inducements,
submission and compliance.
Compliance, yeah. Right? And you know, this was in this Emotions of Normal People, a book that wasn't successful. So we used the comics as a way to kind of portray these messages. And of course, it was very controversial what he was doing at the time. You know, there was a lot of concern, A, about comic books generally sort of, you know, maybe not being the kind of highbrow reading. Although, you know, my impression as a professor is anything that gets students to read is great.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
Absolutely fabulous. Right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, if it's comic books, fabulous, right? And I think that's how some, you know, there were professionals who thought that way, child psychologists, et cetera, like Marston himself. But what is interesting is that, you know, there were some fans who wrote in and kind of said, gosh, you know, I wonder if I'm the only guy who feels this way. But when I, you know, I see a woman being tied up, I, you know, I get excited by that. And so, you know, and Charlie Gaines, you know, and the powers that would be at DC Comics at the time, kind of, you know, would show Marston this stuff, and Marston would, he refused to change anything.
Right.
And it's a story of a creator who gets away with doing what he wants to do because it's selling like hotcakes. And, you know, what's Charlie Gaines going to do? Say no? You know, he keeps telling him, look, change this, do this, do this. But the guy doesn't listen to him, right? You know, and
right.
So that, I think, in terms of the, you know, BDSM sort of thing there is, and of course, Marston also said that he didn't agree with the inflicting of pain, right? So sadism was not something that he agreed with.
Right.
It was more kind of, I think, the kind of bondage that you're talking about, right? That would be pleasant and, you know, and so, and that's what we see in Wonder Woman. And, you know, and of course, there were those who criticized Marston saying, well, you know, how many times does she need to be tied up by, you know, a criminal, right? You're right. She needs to tie them up to take them home. But how many times do they need to tie her up, right? You know,
right.
They never kill her, right? They always tie her up, right? Of course, she's our hero when she has to keep living.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting discussion. Yeah, it's definitely maybe we'll pull that out and do a separate episode on it. Because I think it is an interesting discussion about this sort of peaceful state and you know, how that does that help promote matriarchy? Marston seemed to think it did. So,
yeah.
Unless there are some thoughts unsaid about Marston, shall we go ahead and switch over to the most recent incarnation of Wonder Woman, the movies, the Patty Jenkins movie. First, we'll stick to the original one in 2017 because that's the one that you were writing about in your paper, Walter.
Yeah, I think the most recent one is a whole other issue, discussion about filmmaking, and I can't, and also I'm not really, I haven't seen that one, so
okay,
I'll comment on the more recent one. But this, certainly in this one, I think it's interesting because in the time it was coming out, and the world really feels this is my feeling, has kind of shifted. Anyways, there was a real groundswell of just excitement around female action heroes. Now, as Dawn knows, and Dawn was part of it, I'd had a festival that focused and promoted that. And Walter, of course, that's where we met. You were at that festival. So there was a lot of stuff going on at this time around the female hero. I think this has kind of shifted. And of course, there's all that typical kind of Reddit board backlash and all that stupid stuff. But it doesn't feel quite like we're there yet, but I'm sure we'll, you know, once the genie's out of the bottle, they can't put it back. So I'm sure we'll be able to push it further. But it comes to being in this, I think, kind of heady, exciting time for female heroes. Did you see it, Walter, when it came out? I mean, what was your feeling about it about then when the movie was about to appear?
Well, yeah, I was excited to go and see it. I think I went to the theater like three or four times to watch it, and I took a bunch of notes and wrote a blog, you know, which was published at Oxford. And so, you know, I was trying to digest it, you know, also for, you know, my own academic reasons. But, you know, I also saw kind of an opportunity in it to really hear the Amazons are making the big screen.
Yeah.
And that was exciting. And I also think, you know, Wonder Woman's always been popular ever since her inception. It was kind of probably perhaps even a little overdue, you know, for a film.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I certainly know in my circles, the when is there going to be a Wonder Woman movie had, you know, that conversation had been going on for at least a decade at the point that the movie finally came out.
And, you know, I, the title of the article, I start with a question, the unwanted gaze, question mark. And, you know, the reason I did that, and you had mentioned, you know, the male gaze at the beginning of the podcast, Dawn. And, you know, so I mentioned that because James Cameron, right, was had very negative things to say about the film and how scantily clad Wonder Woman was. But, you know, Wonder Woman's outfit is really very, and I have, you know, two photographs in the article.
Right.
You know, basically, you know, one a screenshot, screen grab from the film, and another, you know, from the Liam Sharp's, you know, version of take on Wonder Woman. And you can see, you know, that costume is really derived from the comics. And it would be hard to fight, you know, in some really confining, I mean, I guess, you know, she could wear pants, right? But, and so I think that, you know, Patty Jenkins' own take on the film was, you know, this is the Wonder Woman that I grew up with, right? That I really wanted to bring to life on the screen. And certainly, I think that there's also a female gaze in the film, right? You know, looking at Chris Pine as Steve Trevor, right? You know, and so there are some things about the film that at least kind of flip that male gaze on its head. And so I found that interesting. And someone said to me along the line that, oh, I think this was one of the anonymous readers for the paper who I, you know, I don't know the name. Oh, you know, Cameron was just jealous, absolutely crazy jealous, right?
I'm sure that has a part of it. I'm sure that definitely takes, you know, is a part of it. There's also a wonderful project out there that's a fan, sort of a fan crowdsourced project called the Hawkeye Project. And it's taking male superheroes and putting them in costumes that their female superhero counterparts would have worn, and also in the sexualized physical positions that we see female superheroes put in all the time. And it's a really wonderful social commentary on how scantily clad a lot of our superheroines are compared to their superhero male counterparts. But I think there is definitely a case to be made that Wonder Woman's outfit is in many ways influenced by her Greek origins, which or the Amazon's Greek origins, that, you know, it's very much like a peplos or a chiton. You have that wonderful reference in your paper to the mosaic of Alexander. And he's wearing something rather similar to that outfit as well as he's in battle.
Yeah, I would certainly agree. And, you know, the Greeks wore this type of a cuirass or a, you know, a breastplate that would then have sort of leather strips hanging down. And something I mentioned at the very end of the article, and those have a particular name in Greek, which is escaping me right now, but I did mark it here. In any event, right, that, so yeah, there is something that comes from the, you know, comes from the, oh, it's a Paturos, right?
Right, yes, yeah.
And there's the flap of a cuirass, right, which is the cuirass is that armor that protects the chest, but then the flaps would hang down covering the groin and the buttocks. In any event, yeah, I mean, I think there are aspects of this that are authentic. There's a braid that Wonder Woman wears that, you know, we see on a statue, a Greek statue as well. So, you know, on the one hand, you do have some aspects of it that are certainly, this is how the Amazons are dressed on Greek vases. But then you could again ask another question as to why the Greeks did that, right? And is that because they were objectifying the female body, right? And you raise a good point, Dawn, and I'm thinking about the work of Carolyn Coca, who's written a lot about, you know, superwomen and Wonder Woman in particular, and, you know, talked about this kind of, you know, way that women's bodies are objectified in the comics. And I certainly didn't mean to downplay that, but, you know, I when I was writing the article, it was kind of, you know, I had sort of two things going on in my head. You know, how is this feminist, right? And, you know, and I didn't want to agree with Cameron too much because I think maybe there was some jealousy there, right?
Right.
On the other hand, you know, I mean, when we look at, you know, at women in comics in general, right? You're right. I mean, bodies are objectified there. And And male superheroes don't have to wear these sorts of things. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
It's a good point.
So the sort of new reinvention, to say it twice, of the backstory of Wonder Woman that happens in the 2017 movie. You know, we have from Greek myth that they're the daughters of Ares. We have also from sort of Artemis legend that Artemis was the goddess of the Amazon. So there's that association there. In Marston, we have that Aphrodite is the goddess of the Amazons and you know, was involved in their creation. And in the Wonder Woman movie, we get it reinvented one more time, which is that she is actually the daughter of Zeus, which is brand new. And that Ares is her mortal enemy.
Right, right.
And I wonder if you have any thoughts on that, about how that sort of colors her role as a heroine.
Let me just begin by saying that the film is very much in tandem with later iterations of the Wonder Woman comic book, right? And so this idea, it's not quite exactly the same, right? But what we find in the comics is, you know, this story where Zeus, you know, has passionate sex with Hippolyta, Diana's mother, and that's how she's conceived. And, you know, she kind of finds this out. And so, and of course, that's where the movie is picking up these ideas, right? So the idea of Wonder Woman's origin and her parentage had kind of changed over time in the comics. And so this is picking up the latter idea. Although the idea that, you know, that she was made from clay and, you know, Zeus had breathed life into her, I think it comes up in the film, if I'm remembering the story correctly.
Yes, yeah.
But that's what her mother tells her. It's not the you know, the
not the,
real
truth,
story.
Exactly. Yeah.
But in the film, she's just the daughter of Zeus, right? She's not really, Hippolyta's not really her, well, I shouldn't say not really, but I would say Hippolyta is not her birth mother, as far as we can tell, but it's not really made clear to us.
Yeah, right? She sort of almost has an Athena aspect in the movie, in that Zeus is her only named parent. And, you know, similar to Athena, who sprung from the head of Zeus, we get this feel that she was somehow created just by Zeus, and that she was given to the Amazons to nurture, but that she is wholly divine. She's not a demigoddess. She's a goddess wholly.
And I think right there is maybe part of the answer to your question, right? I mean, as a heroine, right, she has these incredible superpowers. And so, even for an Amazon, right? And the Amazons are pretty tough in this movie, and some of the stuff they do is amazing, like swinging off of
with
ropes and, you know, taking on the German army from World War One with all of its, you know, machine guns and, you know, mechanized, you know, cannons or whatever they are, right? And you know what I mean, they just defeat them. And I love that scene,
speaking that of, whole fight scene on the beach. Oh my god, it's incredible.
That's the Amazonomachy, right?
It is right
word to say. That's the Amazonomachy. That is the battle between men, right? You know, in ancient stuff, it's usually the Greeks, but, you know, here it's the Germans and the Amazons. And so, you know, that I love that about the film, you know, because all the Amazons are heroic, right?
Yes.
And it depicts, you know, them in a very heroic way. And yeah, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but.
I think it's interesting, though. I do think, for me, that the Zeus parentage is more problematic. It just, it becomes, because I can be very critical of how Hollywood takes a lot of stories, particularly stories about powerful women, and how Hollywood subverts a lot of things. Now, again, this is not a deep criticism of the piece, but it does feel like it's sort of like, okay, we're going to okay this, but we need a little bit of patriarchy here. Let's just give, let's just let the God, the big daddy, bring this Amazon about. Okay. And then you got it. There you go. Here's your check. You know, it just feels like that in that sense. And so that for me is a bit of a problem, but you know, the other iterations I find much more interesting in, you know, Marston's Venus and Mars and that kind of thing. So, but yeah, just, that's just my thought on that.
And it was interesting watching the movie again, because I did the first time I saw it in the theater, and I was there with a whole group of women in filmmaking who we sort of went as a group to go see it and to support it on its opening weekend. But it is an interesting mix of definite feminist values. You know, a lot of the things that Wonder Woman says, you know, when she tells Steve Trevor, "What I do is not up to you." And, you know, this whole idea of his World War One age mentality, just trying to just control the situation and tell her what needs to be done. "You have to trust me. You have to trust me. This is what, you know, I'm going to tell you as the dude what to do." And she just goes off and does her own thing. And of course, you know, is proven right in her idea that the war and the misery of it is actually caused by a god, which he sort of, you know, poo-poos that theory in the beginning. The line, you know, that her mother says, "Be careful in the world of men, Diana, they don't deserve you." But there also is the presence of some other sort of Hollywood familiar tropes, like the idea of the born sexy yesterday trope, when Diana and Steve Trevor meet. You know, she is fascinated by, of course, the first time she's ever seen a man. And we do get some of her gaze looking at him. As you mentioned, Walter, we get a little bit of sort of a turnaround of the male gaze as we look at Steve Trevor as this object that she's never seen before. But then, you know, of course, they have the discussions about sex, and she is very clearly this innocent, naive, inexperienced, beautiful woman when it comes to sex. And so a little bit of that born sexy yesterday trope, because Steve gets to be the one to teach her the ways of love between a man and a woman. And then a couple of comments that the character Sammy makes that just pinged on my radar, which is, you know, the first time he gets introduced, the first time she throws a man across the room in the bar, you know, his comment is, "I'm both frightened and aroused." And then later he says, you know, "There is a whole island of women like her and not a single man among them. How do we get there?" So this idea that despite the fact that she is clearly, you know, her own character with her own agency, the men around her still sexualize her. Yeah, go ahead. Those are my thoughts. If you have anything to add, please do.
Oh, no, that's very, very interesting. And I guess the only thing I was really going to add is I think you're right, and that's a really good reading of the film. There also seems to be a kind of coming of age story going on with her as well.
Yes.
You know, we think of sort of narrative tropes here. And so, you know, she's really kind of naive in the beginning. She doesn't know. Her mother doesn't really want to tell her everything, right?
Right.
She kind of leaves in a hurry anyway. And so she learns over time, you know, who she is, what her powers are. And but also she learns, you know, she sees the world in very simplistic terms, as, you know, it's kind of like, you know, will love triumph over war, right? You know, Ares has to be defeated, and if Ares is defeated, it's all going to end.
Right.
But she doesn't understand that, you know, humans have the capacity for good and evil in and of themselves.
Yeah.
So there's almost a secular kind of reading to it that kind of goes on in a certain way. And I think it's interesting how she sort of evolves to then realize that, you know, this is what the world is.
Yeah, and it sort of launches her on the mission of the rest of her life, which is right, to continue to try to influence human beings individually and society as a whole towards love and away from hate.
Right.
Yeah.
Indeed. Yes.
Yeah. And in that, I think, you know, the movie was quite successful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a great film. And, you know, you could criticize it in certain ways, but I think it, you know, certainly was a great success.
So. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a good moment. Again, a moment in time that hopefully can come back around. So yeah, I think that was definitely really wonderful. I think it's probably a good place to stop and wrap up and just say thank you, Walter, for sort of taking us on this journey of where the movie comes from, and then kind of where, you know, what it sort of was in that moment. So if I had applause, I would play, I would hit my sound effects button. Thank you, Walter.
Well, I and I'm sorry it took me so long to get around to this. I kind of just, I do apologize, but I have to reread stuff because I don't remember my own research at some point, you know.
Of course, yeah. Of course, you've been on to other projects since then. And yeah, I had to rewatch the movie from 2017 because it's been so long since I've seen it, so I needed to refresh my thought. But yes, thank you so much for sharing this wonderful paper with us, and it is online, so we will put in our social media the link to the paper, because it's a great read, and I definitely recommend it to people who are interested in this topic.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I had to finish this up in a great hurry, and it's very long. And so, you know, there's a few places where it's kind of, I think, a bit repetitive in rereading it. But my special issue of the Journal of Lesbian Studies on Amazons is also coming out in April.
Oh, so terrific.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and that's part of what's been taking up so much of my time, but it's almost done. I've got 6 articles that are finished, and I'm just finishing the introduction. So, yeah. So
oh, wonderful. Well, definitely share the link with us when it's out so that we can put it in our social media stuff as well.
Yes, definitely. Sure.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. And thank you, Don Sam Alden.
Thank you, Sean Marlon Newcomb.
And we'll thank everyone for listening. This has been the 34 Circe Salon Make Matriarchy Great Again podcast. We will be back again very soon. Take care.
Take care, everyone, and blessed be.